the actual programs that speak to these commissioning editors more personally and how those projects got off the ground or are still being produced. So yes, it will be a very fun hour and a half. And just to also remind you, we have a few more sessions later this week, including copyright and clearance licensing creativity tomorrow at 10:30, as well as Docs on Demand Thursday at 10:30, followed by Putting the Fun in Factual, our final session at 3:30 that afternoon. And for those who haven't been, we do have micro meetings taking place through Thursday, one floor down, and the Kickstart series also taking place here in the chapel tomorrow afternoon, geared towards emerging filmmakers. HD from A to Z Festivals 101 and My First Doc, where filmmakers in the festival who've just produced, directed their first film will tell us about their experiences with that. And that's it. I'd like to welcome, or rather, give the floor over to Rudy Boutignol.
Thank you. I guess you can hear me, can't you? I can hear me. Welcome, everyone. I'm Rudy Boutignol, and most recently of TVO, and as of last week of the Knowledge Network as the new CEO and president. So I'm kind of switching hats in the middle of this festival, so it's kind of fun, because I imagine a lot of you filmmakers always wear different hats as well. I'm here with two colleagues and friends, Takahiro Hamano from NHK. Welcome, Takahiro. Welcome to Toronto. Back to Toronto. And Nick Fraser from the BBC Storyville. Takahiro, Nick, and I are going to, in the spirit of carte blanche, we're going to take a bit of carte blanche ourselves. Instead of giving you an idea of what formal channel profiles are like, we've been to a lot of those, done a lot of those, you know, where you have to spout the company line and explain very methodically what you're looking for and all the characteristics of a proposal or a project that will get you to yes, the magical yes. And but from personal experience, and Nick and I have been talking about it for some time, and Takahiro and I, you know, I haven't had much time to talk about it, but it's they're looking back on the work that we've commissioned. You know, they're the projects that go through the formal process. They get formally pitched. They get at forums. They get formally developed at forums. Developed with the broadcasters. They go through a long, natural, logical progression. And out emerges certain work. And there are other works that are totally chaotic. They come, you know, they're made by some obsessed filmmaker working on their own, pulling together whatever resources they can out of the formal loop. And somehow they get it to a point where people with money, and in this case broadcasters, can say, yes, I'm interested, let's continue. And when you look, when I look at those two different kinds of projects, it's interesting the ones, what emerges from them, that in the, sometimes in the orderly process, you know what you get, and sometimes you're surprised, good ways and bad ways. And in the other process, it's totally chaotic, and out come some of the gems. And so what we thought we'd do today is talk about the projects that we're particularly passionate about from our own body of work, not things that were necessarily big ratings successes or have other characteristics, but other films that we personally love or admire or like for some particular reason outside of the formal process. And because this, I'm hoping that in this discussion, you'll understand a bit of the thinking that goes around or some insight into how you might get support for your film or where in the development stage of your film project you might jump in with a broadcaster or not. So we haven't had a lot of time to plan for this to choreograph it tightly. So what I'd like to do, if it makes sense, is that we will take questions from the audience as we go. Because if there's a particular topic or subject or, that we've touched on or a question that you want to ask at that moment, we'll see if we can work it in. If it doesn't work, we'll do questions afterwards. But if you have a question, just raise your hand. I'll try to acknowledge it, and then I'll get to you when it's possible. And we have one microphone there and another microphone there. So we'll try to do that. So does that sound good to you guys?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Want to do that? Okay.
Yeah.
Let's try with you, Takahiro. You're going to show, or the film that you're going to talk about is a series, And you want to tell us what it's about and why, what you feel about the project?
Okay. Hi, my name is Takahiro Hamano from NHK. And today I'm going to, actually I'm in charge of international co-production in NHK. And I'm mainly working for HD Channel. So today I'm going to show the short clip named Frontier. Frontier is a new series, feature documentary series. And we are looking for the programs which is unique or challenging, innovative program, in short, you know, something new for the Japanese audience. Because I started this job like 5 or 6 years ago, and I'm kind of a new generation of this area. And when I started this job, when I came to Toronto like 4 years ago, I was so surprised, because in NHK, we only make Japanese style and the Japanese, you know, programs for Japanese audience, fairly domestic. But I found there are a lot of wonderful programs in the world. And, you know, I wanted to make some kind of series which introduce wonderful, you know, world, you know, high standard documentaries. So I pitched this idea to NHK 2 years ago, and finally last autumn I got a permission. So this January I started this Frontier. So in order to you know, make this series accessible to Japanese audience, especially young generation, I made a new, as they say, character, CGI character, which is traveling camera. So, you know, the world documentary is a little bit, strange from the Japanese audience, but I'd like to introduce those programs, you know, understandable for the Japanese audience. So I picked up 4 episodes from Frontier and make it, you know, short clip. So could you?
Well, before we go to the clip, just a little clarification. So these are films that are made by filmmakers in the international marketplace.
Yes.
And they're produced in their original language,
mm-hmm.
are they? And are they linked by theme, or were they just the creative work of individuals?
Okay. First of all, we are going to broadcast 20 episodes this year, and maybe half of them will be acquisitions and half of them are co-production. So I picked up the, you know, very unique ones for Japanese audience. It might not be unique for yours, but I picked up the very interesting filmmaking. So each episode is very different from each other.
So it's an anthology series, and half of them you're acquiring just on the open market,
mm-hmm.
and the other half you're finding at forums, or are people pitching formally at a forum, or people that are approach you in the hallways, or things that you've stumbled across, or
I would say both. You know, sometimes I listen to the forum and find a good program and approach to the producer and, you know, discussion. And sometimes, you know, the producer came to Japan or find someone from NHK in some places and try to, you know, promote his ideas. But sometimes, you know, they don't know NHK system, so they approach to the wrong person who doesn't know anything about co-production. So they bring those, you know, projects to me, and you know, we start to talk about the project.
And before you started this initiative, that NHK didn't do a lot of co-productions, or they didn't do these kind of creative documentaries at all?
Not really. I mean, they did some, but we didn't have the kind of series, so.
Okay. Well, shall we see, look at a clip, and mm-hmm. we'll come back and talk about it? Okay. Frontier.
私は映像の旅人。 も新たな地平を目指している。果てしない人間の想像力が生み出す世界、映像のフロンティアへと旅立とう。美しい星、地球。しかし今、地球は悲鳴を上げている。人類がもたらした地球環境の劇的な変化、人はなぜ自分たちの住む地球を壊し続けるのか。この番組はそんな思いを胸に、スウェーデンの映像制作者が綴った映像史である。
You know, each episode is so different, and but we feel those are the very unique for the Japanese audience, so we picked up the, you know, those episodes.
You know, that strikes me as being, you know, if I have a look at it, it's natural history in there, mm-hmm. and science, technology, and some environmental things. Would that be fair that that's the direction you're going in that series,
well,
or is that,
you know,
just what you selected for the clips? And music, there's an arts program, so that's kind of sits on the side.
Actually, we are very flexible about the genre. So science, nature, art, music, anything could do. But it has to have some kind of innovative art or element. For example, for us, the first, the planet documentary is very unique because this is no narration and there is visual image and music and interviews. That's not so unique in your countries, but in Japan, it is so unique that we decided to use broadcast it, or, you know, using drama techniques and make The Rise of Man is something we feel very new. So,
new in what sense? Because it's got docudrama
film,
in it, or?
But the filmmaking style?
Yeah.
So, of course, the subject has to be interesting. But if it, you know, it's interesting, we'd like to have the style. So you need,
right,
you know, both sides.
Well, looking at that clip, it seems like filmmakers could approach you from just about every angle, right?
Yeah.
So that's promising in terms of NHK. is in terms of social issue, do you Do you do that in Frontiers as well? Do you get into kind of social issue or personal documentaries, autobiographical documentaries?
Could be. And we only broadcast the planet, it's social issue, environment right. issue. And also Iraq in Fragment. It's about the Iraq War. We broadcast
All right,
it.
Iraq in Fragments, right.
Yeah. So
That would go in Frontier as well?
Yep, yep.
Okay, so you really are open to a whole lot of...
Very open.
And does this all, do these titles reflect your point of view as a commissioning editor, of head of documentaries? Are these the things that you think you like or you think should be on the channel? Or are they a result of a team or a committee? Or?
Okay, we have team and we are but only three producers. So each producer bring interesting ideas and discuss what to do and pick up some of them.
Right. So. Okay, I'm just wondering, if there's any questions for Takahiro about NHK, don't be shy, just put up your hands. Because what I thought we'd do then, maybe what we'll do is just, Nick, we should maybe go to the Democracy Project, because that has that had a very specific, in terms of an anthology series, yours seems to be very broad. Democracy was a lot more focused on the subject of democracy, but you had some very... I don't know, it seemed to me when you were developing it that you had some very particular ideas of what you were looking for and what you weren't looking for, like countries you were interested in. I mean, maybe it wasn't you, maybe it was your fellow colleagues.
I'm trying to remember. It took so long that I've sort of forgotten, no doubt, some of the more difficult aspects. I mean, I thought what struck me when you were starting to talk was that this has gone on a long time, and I, you know, this would anyone like me to tell you about Democracy Project, or you'll vaguely know what it is?
I think we should hear what it is.
Okay. Basically, we had this idea after a spectacularly successful series of films in Southern Africa about AIDS. We, all representatives of broadcasters, we thought it was a shame to disband, and we should try and do another large project together. So people said, what should it be? And to my horror, as I later realized, I said, well, it should be about contemporary democracy. Because it's global, because a war is being fought over it, and because we do not know the outcome. We do not judge democracy in the same way in different countries. So it's a perfect vehicle for the pluralism and variety of filmmaking. But we do not know the outcome. We do not know if we live in a democratic century. The last century only just turned out by the skin of its teeth to be a democratic century. So if we were able to do some brilliant films, that would enable us to show them on many broadcasters at the same time, and it would enable us to sort of start a debate. Well, we have 10 films, 28 broadcasters, a date, October the 8th, and some of these films will be shown on that day, all over the world, and within a month, 2 months, 3 months, all the 10 will be shown in these different markets, which is really something. I realized, actually, in the middle of the tribute to Rudy, I've been in a state of cold sweat on this project, actually, for the past 2 years, which is very good for me, because I sort of realized the risks you lot take as filmmakers. In a way, what was most interesting to me personally was that in order to make this project work, I had to go down into the arena again and not sit on a chair pontificating. I had to actually say to people, well, this film is going to work, or this film isn't going to work. And I also, and that changed my life totally, had to work much more with other people than I usually do. And I have a much, much higher respect for the profession of the democratic politician. At a moment when these people are viewed with reprobation or horror or disgust, I go around telling people, no, I'm sorry. I accept the president of the great republic to the south from these considerations. But, it's easy to make mistakes. It is so hard to get people to do things when you have no means of coercion. If you're a CEO of a company, you fire people if they don't know what you want. But in a democratic project, things are voluntary. Anyway, the films coming in, this is my point, have this happy combination of randomness and coherence that I like in good filmmaking. They seem to snatch at the subject, and they seem to tell you things on the run, and tell you things in a non-definitive way. And what Rudy was saying earlier about it's the bane of our lives is the overdeveloped series, preferably in French, running to 40 pages, practically every shot size marked out or every stage of the argument. this is the nightmare. This is the true nightmare for commissioning editors, when you know what the film is going to be before you commission it. And happily, these two films have a, I think the word is aleatory, is it? Is that a good word? Or not? No. All right, they have an unexpected, you know, they live in uncertainty. It's good to live in uncertainty. Documentaries exist as a consequence of uncertainty, and our world is very uncertain.
You know, I mean, in terms of documentary, capturing the unfolding event with the filmmaker discovering something that they themselves didn't know when they started, and when you see that on camera, I find it to be the most exciting part of the process.
Well, I think we have to get better at ensuring that.
But you know, I guess the conundrum, and I've been on both sides of the table there between being a producer and being a funder, is that, you know, it's hard to get money for an idea, you know, unless you give somebody some kind of rationale to say yes. And so that filmmakers, I'm wondering that we ourselves put filmmakers in that difficult position where we ask them to articulate a lot. And sometimes it's so, it's taken so literally, or we've communicated it so literally that we end up with a shot list of everything that's going to happen, which of course is, well, it's one thing to read it. You don't want to watch it all over again as a documentary. So that if you don't explain what the project is, you're not going to get any support. And if you over-explain it, you're not going to get any support. So it's a conundrum that we work in. Should we look at this clip and then come back to the Democracy Project?
Why not? Let's
look. What is this?
Clip is, we held many pitches, including one here, which is graven in my memory as one of the most embarrassing moments in my professional career, and I apologize to anyone who showed up for it. But these films were assembled through pitches.
Well, I'm glad that you could come here to atone for it.
I'm atoning, I'm deeply. So they're assembled through, and it was quite interesting to me, long after we'd been out in the world and asking for films, we'd find ourselves working on an effort, let us say, it's the African one, right, first?
Yeah.
To get an African film for 6 months, and, you know, four projects had gone down. And we spent a lot of money, which we had to pay back, by the way, to the EBU, European Broadcasting Union, on development. We spent more money than I ever expected to on projects and went down. And suddenly, these people sent me a film about Liberia. We turned down one project about Liberia, and these people out of the blue just said, we have unlimited access to Sirleaf Johnson, first woman head of state in Africa, the president of Liberia after a dreadful civil war. What do you think of this? Wonderful.
You know, this has got some local flavor. The prime minister, she came to visit Canada, somehow the prime minister couldn't find time to see her, so that was quite a...
That's a bit...
It's interesting, this is about her. Yeah. So let's... I'd love... Can we
roll She's back? With George Soros. I think you need to know that.
She lives with George Soros?
No, she's with him in the clip. No, Queen Noor of Jordan lives with
him. I was going to say, I'm really out of the loop.
Yeah.
George Soros to help her strategize on the debt problem.
How did you leave it with the Chinese? Because somehow it seems to me that there's this large cake that you really ought to get a slice of it. They have a trillion dollars, and they earmarked $5 billion for Africa to invest in Africa, and some commitment indication of interest on the part of the Chinese, then I think one could get the IMF to speed it up in order to liberate that money. So go for the jugular.
His point is, by having such an offer in your hand, going to them to say, yeah, we know we can't do this, but just look at the potential. You're not helping us. You're not allowing someone else to help us, I think.
It wasn't too long after Ellie hosted a Chinese that she got an invitation to come to Washington.
Today I'm going to meet with President Bush. Just, I don't know how well we're doing. Getting political blessings for the support on our debt. On the totem pole when it comes to partnership and support for Liberia development. They're just starting. Yes, they have big plans. Yes, they have big appetite for raw material, but...
For us, the United States relationship is still the number one. Still a key for us because
they set the pace. When they take a step, much of the rest of the world follows, including China. Then I'm out of here and get away from this ice.
Madam President, thanks for coming.
Thanks.
Thrilled to talk to you, friend. And we want to help you. We really do.
As we told you, we just came to get this debt off our backs.
That's right.
you were wondering whether or not it was possible to achieve your dreams. And you asked for our help. I was impressed by your spirit, and so I pledge our ongoing help.
Thank you, Madam President. Thank you very much.
The United States currently holds $391 million in outstanding bilateral claims on Liberia. We will cancel that debt, all of it, under the framework for highly indebted countries.
Okay.
Okay. Cut the clip.
It's all right. Okay.
And that's the Iron Lady of Liberia.
Well, she's got two other women in her cabinet. The chief of police is a very redoubtable person, and the treasury minister, who you could see around the table. And this bit comes at the end of the film. I mean, you see her inaugural moment. You see her getting to grips with this, you know, terrifyingly poor and, you know, racked by a violent country. And this comes near the end when actually things are going quite well. So the whole film, it's very encouraging. And you develop this, I do, admiration and love for this remarkable person. I mean, I, you know, think she's really terrific. So, but it's not sort of positive in a corny way. It's not sort of saying, look, isn't it wonderful? Here's a woman in charge of, because she's not like that. I mean, that's farthest from her, you know, consciousness. She just is there, she wants to do something, she's damn well going to do it. And I do think the moment when George Soros, you know, this great billionaire, recommends her to play the Chinese off against the Americans is very wonderful. I don't know how you get moments like that on film, but it's incredible. It's good.
So they'd been shooting this?
Yeah, they shot a bit of it.
And they approached you?
Yeah, and then they said, like, how did I feel about this? So I said, yeah, can a duck swim or whatever. And then I said I would then go to my, I mean, just to tell you, the Democracy Project is commissioned through this, it's basically a board, or it's a mini NGO, of which myself and various commissioning editors are members. So if we have a deficit, our houses are on the line, right? I mean, you know, we'd have to remortgage our houses or whatever, we're deficit at the end of this. And it's based in Copenhagen, but we established this so that we as commissioning editors could commission these films. And what we didn't want, as had been done with projects like this in the past, was to hand over commissioning power to broadcasters. We want to say, as a group, we think, you know, obviously we had fantastic numbers of rows in the group over what to commission. And I think on the whole, this was reasonably, underlined reasonably easy. I mean, I said, I think we must do this. This is great. The fact that it's the dimension of you know, it's got an African-American dimension, doesn't really matter, because apart from anything, she's a wonderful person, and you will find that South African Broadcasting Corporation, who are one of our partners, will like the idea of a woman exercising power in Africa. And indeed they did. And indeed they've invited her down to Johannesburg for the premiere of the film. So it went through our system. We got some money from ITVS. I think it had been pitched to ITVS before, but when we got involved, ITVS took it, and the package of financing was arranged. And that was one of the easier films, I think.
Right. The you said this was not being done through the commissioning system, but the organization was made up of commissioners, right?
Yes, but...
So that's one thing, you know, yes. Just to...
Does everyone get that, or shall I...
I mean, I'm in the business. I don't quite get it. You know, you've been explaining it to me for about 2 years.
Let me spool back and explain. When you have had large international magazine or collections of shows in the past, what they've done is they've said, NHK, a partner, by the way, they've said, why don't you, the BBC make one film and NHK make another film and CBC another film. And what tends to result from this is that the shows are very uneven in quality. And because we had worked this way on Steps in Africa, on the AIDS films, we decided to create an editorial board. And we would be responsible for raising the cash from the broadcasters and seeking outside funds, and generally, supervising the whole project editorially and logistically and production-wise, and making sure it worked on the internet, of which maybe more later, etc., etc. But the key to the whole thing is that, the shareholders or the members of the editorial board, through this non-profit-making organization based in Copenhagen, are commissioning editors or broadcasting executives. And I hope we'll go on with this model. I hope that after democracy, we can find another way of collaborating, because although it was quite difficult this time because of the size of the project, I think it's a very good way to work together. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense, actually. And it's an interesting follow-up to the model that had been around about 10, 15 years earlier, where you're right, in international co-productions, where there would be an interest of 10 broadcasters from 10 different territories, usually 10 different countries, wanting to create some kind of an anthology series, and every broadcaster doing one. And that was the inherent problem. You get 10 different things, each with their own national peculiarities, usually because of the funding system or some particular audience demographic of the particular broadcaster. This is an alternative model. I was part of the STEPS project early on, which was focused on this idea. Just for the sake of the audience, who were the key broadcasters on the editorial board? I mean, the group. There's a small group, right?
Yeah, in Europe, there was Arte from France and Germany. There was TV2 from Denmark, who were very important, proportionate to the size of, you know, broadcasting or Danish economy. There was NHK, very important, though we haven't got their money yet, I have to say. Japan, I mean, the check is in the post, right?
we'll make a note for Takahiro to take anyway, back, if you could.
And then obviously there was the ye good old BBC, maybe of which more later, and latterly CBC. And those are the principal core. There was a working group drawn mainly from these Northwest Europe broadcasters. Latterly, also ITVS arrived on the scene from America. Claire Aguilar, who's absolutely fantastically important, her contribution. I mean, I was told by my colleagues, I must never talk about difficulties. They say, never talk about difficulties. It'll bore people and they'll think you're just negative. But it was quite difficult assembling, you know, support from certain countries. And I'm not... Maybe it's not, you know, not no news to you, but the PBS system is quite difficult to deal with. I think that could count as the largest understatement so far of my spiel.
you know what that reminds me of, and I want to get in a minute, Takahiro, your opinion on the Democracy Project, because you're involved with it, right?
My colleague is involved.
Oh, your colleague is involved with it. So.
He is great.
But it's interesting, just the other day, meeting with some people from the Documentary Organization of Canada looking at the policy paper, and one of the items there was international treaty co-productions. And thinking, particularly in documentary, I know very few people that are doing international treaty co-productions. These are the formal co-productions. I think we're
doing... Do I have to know what they are, really?
No, hopefully you won't, but the interesting thing, and I think we have one at TVO, we had one that's going through the works, but it's a producer, Mark Johnson, very sophisticated.
I think we should all make lists on a piece of paper of things we would like not to exist.
Yes, well this
and one
you
will
won't.
Be treaty co-productions.
Well, treaty co-production. Yeah. And it's interesting how there was...
Would the Canadian Constitution be on the list?
It could be, but you'd have to find somebody who knew what it was.
Much of the acquis social or the... Communitaire, you know the 30,000 statutes on the EU? I mean, it would take you about half a lifetime to read all of the statutes that comprise the EU legally. But I don't you think one just forgets about these things like co-production treaties?
Well, you know what? Yeah? My observation at the time was it caused me to reflect that a lot of all the international work that we've done together, and we've done, 10, 12 years
Absolutely.
Worth of co-productions and work together, how none of it has been official
Absolutely.
Treaty co-productions. And so that there's, through these forums, like the Toronto Documentary Forum, Amsterdam Forum, that they're out of the frustration of dealing with country-to-country negotiations or broadcaster-to-broadcasters, rather than through official structures that people have just gone to the individuals, like yourself, Takahiro, like Nick, like a group of other commissioning editors from those broadcasters, and made informal agreements based on the project, based on the filmmakers. And they exist totally outside of the official structure. They're not even captured in the statistics. So even our government hasn't got a clue how much real international co-production happens. Yeah. Because filmmakers can't afford the expense and the Byzantine bureaucracy associated with it. It's valuable in certain projects, like fiction projects that have big subjects. But in the kind of world that we live in, that everyone's kind of bypassed that system and immediately gone face-to-face with commissioning editors. And so, and what your model, the Democracy Project's model was based on steps. And again, this was something that was being workshopped when we were doing our summer teaching course in Denmark.
Yes.
And it came out of a project of, hey, what if we AIDS is incredibly rampant in certain parts of the country. What if we focused on one country, South Africa? Just that.
Well, no, it was all the countries of Southern Africa, actually. It was
Southern Africa. But it was Southern Africa.
Southern Africa, yeah.
And what if we focus on that to the exclusion of all others, just to see if we could get a critical mass going to get some kind of public awareness, right?
I mean, I think
and it was workshopped from one producer, it was Don Eakins, and Ika Vekalati from Finnish television,
who
just decided, you know what, let's just workshop it, and workshopped it there. And the idea wasn't just to make films on AIDS, but it was to get South Africans to make films on AIDS, to get South Africans to acquire certain skills, to make a whole set of films. And everybody kind of piled in and just gave their money, and some people, individual commissioning editors, went there to support the project. And out of it came this idea that, you know, during International AIDS Day, that broadcasters all around the world, by then it was 20 or 30 of them, had really, there was programming focusing on the issue of AIDS and HIV infection in Southern Africa globally, with absolutely no official government intervention. It was just individual filmmakers.
Which is a perfect model. Now, just let me tell you, a big discovery of the Democracy Project for me, and I like to talk more about consequences and process, is that the real problem about public broadcasting, the reason if it dies, it will die because it is localized in a global age. I mean, nobody, none of you, there's quite a young average audience here, will give a damn about questions like British content or Canadian content. I imagine that is, unless you need the work, I imagine that you watch films because they're beautiful and they speak to you no matter where they come from in the world. And this is new. This is new in the last 20 years. But I have to tell you that broadcasters are only just waking up to it. And they will be hit by, you know, the digital system. But the sooner they wake up to it, the better. And I think it's been very interesting doing both these projects, which have both been a sort of learning curve for the BBC. In the first one, the AIDS thing, the BBC was pretty, oh, what is this, etc. They like some of the films. But in the past month, I've been really amazed by it. Now the 10 films are here, that BBC is running this on every network, on BBC World globally, BBC World Service. They have a Parliament channel where they're going to run all the films on one day, on BBC Two, on BBC Four, on Radio Four, etc. And I think there is a real lesson here. I think that, you know, all of us who have anything to do with public broadcasting, inside it or working for it, we got to really change. We got to adapt the system so it's responsive to, you know, globalized interests, globalized world. And I just think of these projects as means to that end, really. I mean, other people will come along with much more sophisticated, much cleverer, maybe much simpler ways of doing that, but it has to happen. And if it doesn't happen through the BBC and CBC and all up on NHK, it will happen via Cisco Systems and George Soros and new media. So, you know, there's a warning here, but a huge opportunity.
Takahiro, do you represent that kind of change in the NHK system? Because it was quite monolithic for many people. Not your words, but insular, looking at, you know, very localized content or a local point of view?
NHK is very unique broadcaster in the world, I guess.
I think it should be the motto, very unique.
But is that unique in a good way or in a bad way?
We are very domestic. And, I've been doing this for 5 or 6 years and still international co-production is very rare cases. And my daughter and I always talk about in the midnight, you know. I would like to have more friends inside NHK about the international co-production. So we you know, the most difficult part for me is to negotiate with NHK executives. You know, let them understand what we are doing, because they don't care about international things. So, but this democracy project or frontier, we are trying to change a little bit, you know, gradually.
Yeah. And is that because it's driven by your interest or the interest of your organization?
Well, some of producers' interest.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
I mean, are these part of the official plans of NHK that says, you know, Japanese people in a globalized world are too insular? We need to know more about what's going
Actually,
on.
Actually, I feel like the audience, you know, would like to watch that kind of programs.
Yes. Yeah.
But only the organization don't realize I'm part of that. So once we broadcast those, you know, programs, the reaction is so, I mean, great. We had a lot of positive reactions. So then, you know, we could change a little bit.
You know, it's interesting. It speaks to what Nick said about the fact that if you don't provide it on your public service broadcasters, audiences will go look for it somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I had an observation, I think it was last November in Amsterdam, and Amsterdam is the big mother of all pitching forums, and everyone from around the world shows up. And every territory, you know, every country, several territories within that country, several different broadcasters, sometimes competing with each other in their own country. And it's been quite a robust way and to promote collaboration between international broadcasters, commissioning editors, and filmmakers. And I remember Belgium, the Flemish-speaking Belgium, VRT. And Paul Pauwels was the commissioning editor there. And for a number of, you know, for the time that Paul had been there, all of a sudden, a whole territory had opened up, you know, from Flemish-speaking Belgium. All of a sudden, they're pre-buying lots of stuff. They would pre-buy projects like this. They'd put up money. Very progressive, creative work. And then they had a reorganization, and Paul was gone. And I remember going around the table and realizing, because one individual left, that territory disappeared.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't like there was a logical progression. It wasn't like the network said,
no.
Geez, this is part of our plans. We do this because it's important, not because some individual is excited about it. I mean, that's helpful, it gets things going. And it made me realize of how, you know, how personal, if filmmaking is very a personal activity, you decide you're passionate about something and you decide you're going to do it for no other reason that you want to do it. It's the same thing inside the commissioning system that sometimes there are very passionate individuals who will broadcast something not because it's the mandate of the organization, but rather they just feel that this is really important for their audiences to understand. If you don't give it to them via television, they're going to get it somewhere else, and so you do it.
Yeah.
And what do you think of that, Nick? Do you agree with
me? No, I think that's true. I think I'm very lucky to work in the BBC, where really the BBC DNA is, you know, the motto is "Nation shall speak, peace unto nation." I'm not sure where the peace belongs in the history of the BBC. Never mind about that. But I think that's what the BBC is supposed to do, and people know it. But so if you say in the BBC that's what we should be doing, they can't reject it. They may say yes, but we want much more higher rated shows are going to appeal to middle England or deep England, but they're not going to say no, and it's part of what the BBC does. But I do have a fantastic sense of urgency about really internationalizing what we do additionally. I if there was anything I could do to speed up the process or to make the process irrevocable so that it didn't matter if VRT fell off the map, I would do it. And when I've got finished with Democracy, I want to have a think about this, because it seems very important. It seems very important to know how to use the new capability of, you know, digital and the internet to do this, and so that the audience doesn't further fragment into impossibly tiny segments. And I don't think we have the first idea how to do that, but it will be done. And if not me, someone else should start doing it.
Well, the BBC has been a leader worldwide, but I often, you know, I often wonder that for the rest of the world, it's almost an impossible example to use. You can't use the BBC anywhere else as an example to anywhere else because it exists nowhere else, you know, in the sense of an incredibly well-funded public service broadcaster media organization now that's embedded into the culture of the United Kingdom. I can't imagine anyone killing it, whether they wanted to or
not.
Well,
they've given us less money, you know, because they thought we were sort of bloated and overfunded.
The BBC in general, or?
Well, the government settlement is not as generous as it was supposed to be. There's a certain punishment going on for BBC's refractory behavior, I think.
But talking about not more money in BBC terms to people that live in countries like Canada, you know, you're talking...
No, but I think you see that you can, what you have to do now is I had, in the course of doing this project, one of the good moments, of the many, many good moments, was spending an afternoon with Jeff Skoll of Participant Productions in eBay, a Canadian, by the way, Syriana, you know all about Jeff Skoll. And I think the way he runs his company is very interesting. When they have a new project, they just take a blank sheet of paper and they put the title of the project at the top and they figure out the utility and likelihood of success of the project in every single media application. So I don't actually think, it's quite well funded, Skoll, but I think you'll find that the future is quite bright, but many initiatives will not require the sort of massive amounts of cash that BBC has had in the past. In new media, it will be possible to assemble cash from different sources. And the question will be not really how you assemble the cash, but how you have the marketing clout to make sure that in the new system, enough people get to watch your shows. I don't want to go on with that. You probably want to talk more about content of shows, but it does sometimes upset me. There's a marvelous film called The Devil Came By on Horseback, about Darfur. And I love the film. It seems to me, like many, many American films, a sort of exemplary film about the contemporary world. I mean, it tells you in a way no one understudy could fail, or no one overstudy could fail to be, so understand what's going on in Darfur and be moved by this film. But the depressing thing is, and I've talked to filmmakers, they share it, is in the end this film will not be watched by enough people. If the film had been made much less interestingly as a CBS special 20 years ago, it would have reached many more people. And, you know, when you add up the audiences for theatre, for our sort of minority channels, for DVD, for festivals, big fetish of festivals, I'm afraid, the more less films reach big audiences, the more festivals become important. And that is all quite upsetting. And if you put in counterpoint to that, just another instance, Why We Fight, another good film, was it been shown in Canada yet? Sure. Yeah, okay. I think it took around, Eugene's film took around about $2.5 million in cinema. But, he to his annoyance, it went on YouTube, and within 2 weeks it had 500,000 downloads. So we are talking about huge numbers if we can only find them. And I think we really have to get public broadcasting in particular more imaginative about helping filmmakers find these. It should not be... We should be collaborating with filmmakers to make sure somehow their films reach absolute maximum audiences. And I don't think we're very good at doing that. I think there's a lot of re-education needed on this count. It's really necessary. And that would be another thing I'd hope to use the Democracy Project to try to get moving in the BBC.
I'm going to show something just on picking up on what you talked about. But I'm just wondering, any questions from the audience for Nick or Takahiro? We okay? Nobody? Okay. I've decided to show something not recent because there are five films that I commissioned. I think I just recognize the pattern in them myself. The Bodybuilder and I is here at the festival. So if you've seen it, that's one. So I'm not going to show that today. I'm going to show something from about 4 years ago. The Bodybuilder and I, Girl Inside by Maya Gallas, I see Maya right there. Last Call to Gladstone. Kike Like Me that's playing tonight. And, oh my God, I can't remember the other one. Lovable. It was so lovable. It was a real crowd pleaser last night. But anyways, I just realized they're all intensely autobiographical or almost. And what I'm going to show you is not quite the same, but it's the idea of a, you know, it's the personal film. It's something that I've been supporting for quite some time. Nick makes fun of me a lot about that.
The personal film?
Yeah, yeah. We have a lot of arguments about that. But good arguments, although we don't agree but on stuff. But here's a film, you know, it was an interest. This is a film, a personal film. It's not about the filmmaker. She's in it. It's Alison Murray. It's called Train on the Brain. She's in the film. It's not about her, though. And but I loved the way that this came about, because for me, it's about the magic of this process, and it's the chaos. And it turned out to be one of my favorite films. And Alison Murray was a Canadian expatriate who had grown up in London and was into the dance world. She was doing dance films and the like, and some fiction films. And Alan Hailing at Channel 4 had given her some development money to do films on young people that ride the rails in Canada. And I remember I was in Amsterdam working at the Forum, and in between, and that's pitches for every 15 minutes for 3 days straight. So you really hear a lot of pitches, and in between, when it's time to go for a break, you get pitched informally, which is, I love, the process is incredible. It's a bit fatiguing, but it's an incredible process. And just as I was leaving the table, Allison, this young person, kind of tugged at my sleeve and said, "Can I have 5 minutes of your time?" And it's like, "What?" And she goes, I'm an ex-Canadian. I'm living in London. I'm doing a film on Train on the Brain. Can I show it to you?" And I said, "Oh, that's..." I said, "Hobos?" And she said, no, young people." I said, "Okay, well, give me a... You have something?" And I have a DVD. And so I took it, because it's a one way to escape quickly. I think I really had to go to the washroom, because I'd been drinking water and coffee all session. And so I went back, and along with the hundreds of pitches and DVDs in my bag. And about 3 or 4 weeks later, I get a call from Alan Hailing, who's a colleague of ours, has been back and forth between Channel 4 and BBC. And they were having a regime change at Channel 4, and of course they get rid of they get rid of waves of commissioning editors, and whatever projects you're working on are going to die. That's just what happens. All your development projects get killed. So Alan phoned me up and said, "There's this great project by Alison Murray called Train on the Brain." I think it was called Train Spotting at the time. "Train on the Brain. I gave her development money, and instead of developing the project, she went out and shot it for 6 weeks, which she shouldn't have done, because the development was supposed to be to develop the project." Right. But of course, Alan, being the great commissioning editor, let her do whatever she wanted to do. And he said, I'm being fired, regime change, so they're going to kill my project. I really think you should have a look at the project. I highly recommend it." And I said, "Fantastic. Have her send me the DVD." He said, "It's probably in your pile. Look at the pile. I'm not going to hang up till you look in your pile." And I did, and I found the DVD. And it was a 15-minute rough assembly of certain scenes. And I just loved it. And I happened to be going to London on some volunteer work a couple of weeks later. And I arranged to see the cut, 75-minute cut. And I'm going to show you the clip right now, because this is a personal film done on the cheap initially to get it shot. They just went out and shot it on development money. And I came in afterwards. So could we roll the clip? It's actually, you can relax, sit back. It's about 8 minutes, because I didn't have the heart to cut it. I hope I gave him the right cues.
It's
lawyer, banking, manufacturing, and okay. Corporate lawyers.
That's
a century
clip.
And a half ago,
can
realized
we, stop?
They needed more power.
Okay, it's track, I think there's four tracks on this. Yeah, track four. Could we try? If you go to this is the corporation. Try the next track. No. No, it's a four. No, this is the corporation. There should be a menu on that. I checked it on my Macintosh. You have a Macintosh there? There it is. Oh, yes, that one. Yes, please. Thank you.
This close.
No, you weren't.
Well, I was only halfway from Massachusetts.
You're still halfway, just further south. You had to go south anyway to get there.
So we're going back north. We're just going to backtrack and go back up. We'll get there. We'll get to Iowa.
Think we'll get there in time for the Iowa convention? We're stuck in the middle of open countryside. It's a long way to the next train yard before we can get off. We're way off course, yet somehow we don't mind. Wendy's told me about the drift, a carefree state of mind that overtakes you on the train. I'm losing all sense of time and place. My life in London seems far, far away.
When I wake up, someone will sweep up my lazy bones. We will rise in the cool of the evening. I remember the way that you smiled when the gravity shackles were wild. But something is breaking when I think it's all beginning.
Oh, shit!
Bridge. So we're sitting there in the heat, trying to decide what to do. This guy appears out of nowhere.
What's your name again?
Travis.
Travis.
Nice to meet you. Lindsay, how old is everybody?
Guess. Yeah, you gotta guess.
16. 17.
Come on.
18. 16.
Huh?
No.
25.
25?
Yeah. So you left your stuff down here, and you went to work, and then you came back to get your stuff, is that right?
Yeah, well, the job sucks.
I just recently was in California. I went to Los Angeles first. And then stayed in Hollywood, did a little bit of acting, modeling. I've been riding trains for about 3 years. My name is Rails. Hell, I'll come with you, I guess. I don't know. I mean, really, there isn't really much
to stay
in here.
It's nice to be free, because you can just go whenever you want.
Travis is a bullshit artist who wandered out of the bushes. He'd been sleeping on rooftops and working as a waiter during the day. He's ready to get out of Nashville.
It's nice. He has a lot of common with me. That's weird. Like, everything he said, I did. He had in common with me, like, everything I could relate to.
You probably find a lot of people who have a lot in common with you when you're traveling.
Yeah.
Wendy, Todd, and I are feeling somewhat skeptical about our new friend.
What do you think?
I'm putting it on that.
Is this lying down? Come back. We're gonna go on the other side of that train, and we're gonna walk behind it so the tower can't see us, and we're gonna walk all the way to the bridge, and then we'll cross back over.
What the hell's going on? None of the trains seem to be stopping. Once again, we rely on the workers. It's cool that they keep up the tradition of helping hobos. Wendy discovers we're in the wrong yard altogether.
Nothing from here going west. He says for sure going to that other yard if the plot's going to Memphis. I asked him what time crew changes were, and he's just like, all the time.
16 hours after arriving in Nashville, we finally pulled out on another train.
Travis and Lindsay are that five cars up in a boxcar. We had a little chat with them last night because we're not feeling very comfortable traveling with them. Travis seems to think he knows everything there is to know about riding trains, but his behavior so far has demonstrated that he's pretty careless.
What are you doing on there?
Is that up here? Yeah, every time we go by a crossing, and we see a car, we point the gun
at it. You know, you might get us kicked off if you do that. You should really hide when you go through the crossing.
Make sure we do it in the country, where nobody knows.
Okay.
You want to see your body is fucking flat
on. If the train stops suddenly, you might just go bang into the ditch.
60 miles an hour.
After their night together in the boxcar, Lindsay is feeling freaked out by Travis.
A little too fast, I guess. The man's already talking about marriage and moving to Ireland. It's kind of scary.
When I was your age, I was like doing similar kind of stuff. And I would just feel really bad. Kind of putting you on a train and then sending you off with him and something bad happening.
I'm 16 and I'm not ready to say I'm gonna have this many kids and their names are gonna be and I'm gonna move here and we're gonna do this and that. I'm not ready for that. I'm still, I just got on the road, I'm supposed to be traveling. I'm not ready to, I guess, get that deep so fast. He only knew me for a day and he already been talking like he loves me.
The train is just creeping along. It's 110 degrees. We're running out of water. We can't exactly ask the conductor to stop the train and let us off.
Rationing water for the next 4 hours. Get this much water each hour between the three of us. So in about half an hour, we're going to split up this portion of water here in three ways. And then an hour from then, split up this portion, so on. That's all we got.
That's really good. That's
really good. So this is, again, Alison Murray, who's doing another film that I commissioned, but this was a case of the filmmaker just deciding, rather than doing a lot of formal proposals, she took the money for development and shot for 6 weeks herself. That was Alison, who's narrating, you see on camera. She shot on some kind of a portable DV camera and some high Super 8 footage. But I liked her sensibility because she was talking about young people. She was the music that they were using was contemporary. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of one of those informal projects. Came out of the blue. I liked it a lot. Went in the editing room, and loved it right away. Loved the whole cut of it. And put some money into it. Yeah. And then it was interesting because, and this is how things happen. So. She was working with a producer, Anne Beresford, and they had no domestic support from the UK once Alan was out of the picture, Alan Haley. So at one of the hot dogs, Nick was at my house, and we had some friends over in the backyard just chatting about stuff, and I said, hey, Nick, there's a real opportunity to put one over on Channel 4. They're walking away from this development project, but I really like the film. Why don't you take it? So I think, Nick, when you got back to the UK, you called the filmmaker to ask for a cut.
Yeah.
But because they had development money from Channel 4, if they had another UK broadcaster interest, they were legally obliged to go back to Channel 4. Peter Dale was there, old chum of yours.
That's right, rival.
And, yes, and the minute that Peter Dale heard that the BBC was interested, he immediately asked for a screening. Yeah. And the producer phoned me back 2 days later and said, you know, I've been trying to reach those guys for some time. And I couldn't, out of the blue, both of them call me. It's fantastic. What happened? And I said, it's easy. More than one person wanted your project, you know? And but it was interesting because this project came totally out of the blue. And just to let you know, I think we had 10 plays on it, and we probably took every single play on it because every time we play it, we'd get a really great audience, above average audience. Yeah. And what I discovered was that Canada has a railway police, and the railway policeman came to visit me to remind me that this activity is illegal. And he had a badge and a black hat, looked like those Wells Fargo guys. And I said, well, look, we can't censor it, that's what it is, but I think we agreed that we would put a disclaimer saying the activities you're going to see are illegal, and that was good. But what I loved, you know, what I loved about it was because, quite frankly and honestly, if she'd come to pitch me the film, you know, a bunch of kids riding the rails, I don't know if I would have said yes on it. I just don't know if I would have been with it enough to say, does this speak to anybody? But clearly, when she had the evidence of it, I could see that this spoke to young people, and the people that were riding the rails were disaffected youth. This was another way that youth was dealing with their own pressures in a way that was different from my own experience, completely unique. So that was an informal project. And I've come to really love this film. I love it for a lot of different reasons, even though it's quite ragged.
I don't think that. I think it's great about it. It is ragged. I do think, actually, you know, that it's actually the sort of film that we need more and more at the BBC, BBC 4, because, you know, we need more and more of these half hours for the early evening that fit together in little series. But I don't know. I mean, really, I'll ask you this question. I mean, it is you say, would you have commissioned it if there hadn't been any material?
Well, I don't know. You know, I think half the time, sometimes when I listen to my weird inner self, and then I do it, you know, and I am okay. But then a lot of times, if I rationalize it, well, does it fit in this slot?
I agree.
So when I rationalize it, that I might not have. And what worries me about it is that, geez, about that other half of time when I should have just said yes.
I know, but some of the times your inner self says no when it ought to be saying yes. So it works both ways, I think.
Although I think what the importance is that I do like, one characteristic is I do love commitment, you know, and I love it when somebody demonstrates to you that commitment to an idea, not an idea that they sat in their backyard having a cigarette and a beer and saying, hey, this would make a good documentary. Me having a beer and a cigarette, that'd make a great documentary. You know, and I think I've been pitched that already. Which, come to think about it, maybe, no.
But this showed
a commitment, right? She went on the rails for 6 weeks, put a lot of money on her credit card, so she clearly was committed more than a piece of paper.
So let me ask you this question. You give her, how much, $20,000 Canadian,
et cetera. Yeah.
Let's say you did. And she comes back with, 60 hours of material shot?
Yeah.
So what is the process there? Are you filled with admiration that she's done this, or filled with guilt that makes it you feel obligated to go ahead and commission it?
Nah, I rarely feel guilty about anything.
Well, no, I kind of do, actually. I feel that if people knock themselves out to do that, then it's any good, you should commission it.
No, but listen, you know what, on a personal level I feel bad, but at the same time, as a public broadcaster, it's not my money, you know, it's in the public trust. You do have to exercise some it's different. It's somebody else's money. So it's not, you know what, in that case, I did give her $20,000 because it wasn't a Canadian project, technically.
Yes.
You know, so all we normally would have put $10,000 in that project, and I gave her $20,000 because that's as much as I could do it. But in her next project, which was Canadian, although the subject isn't Canadian, it's carnies. You know, the people that do the carnival circuit, the really low-level stuff. And we gave her because it was a Canadian production, we've actually gave her the full amount. I can't remember if it was $50,000 or $60,000 plus the CTF envelope or as much money as we could. But no, I didn't, you know, I wouldn't have felt guilty there because that was her first big work and I was helping her out. And then, you know, and she helped me out by making a good film and that was my success.
So what point do you think when people go out and film something, at what point can you say, yes, that's just not just an idea, but that's actually a project and I want it? I mean, How much they've had to film or edit, or does it vary so much?
Yeah, I think it really varies. We've been at a lot of festivals, and jump in.
Yeah.
Sorry, not to me, Rick and Rudy and Nick show, but it really varies. We've been a lot of pitching forums where somebody shows you a clip, and it's... And it's fine, you can see it. But that clip, it's really special in the sense that if it's a clip that indicates that something about the character that's unique, or something about a developing plot line that is interesting and truly a plot line, and combined with all that, if you can see that the director knows which direction to point the camera, because a lot of times there's great stories.
Yeah.
And the camera's pointed in the wrong direction. You know, philosophically, you think, no, the story's happening behind you. You just turn the camera. So sometimes you just see a scene. Montages rarely work in terms of selling. They rarely work, right? You're always looking for an intact scene, you know, some that shows you know how to a drama. You understand the drama as it develops, and you keep your eye on it, and you don't turn away when it becomes embarrassing. But Takahiro, are these? Would that be something that you'd look at in for Frontier, or is that too?
Well, you know, one of the programs would be something like that, because the documentary has to capture the moment, something happening. So that's one of them, of course. The programs, but at the same time, for the Frontier, we like the new approach to the subject. So, like animation documentary or something that would work. So, there are some ways.
Oh yeah. Okay. Are there questions? There. Okay. Yeah, we've got some questions. Right. One here and then one here. Please, if we could have a microphone here and here. Yeah, right here.
Most of the clips from NHK seem to really be high def oriented because of the subject matter seemed to fit that. Whereas the clip that you pointed out, Rudy, was very, shot maybe with a three-chip camera or something, and certainly high def. The technology part is not relevant there. And with the tendency now for most broadcasters who want everything in high def, I mean, in your question whether NHK would fit that into Frontier, if I was the broadcaster, I'd say absolutely not.
Well, Takahiro and Nick, you want to talk about
I don't give a damn. Okay. I mean, I really, Storyville is, one of the last outposts of low-def films. And I'm really only interested in what films say. And actually, I think some people use high-def wonderfully, but others, it looks frighteningly awful. And maybe that's nothing to do with high-def, I don't know. But people will shift to high-def, but they'll just use the cameras in a different way,
But the question was whether,
And it's still love high-def.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, NHK is actually a pioneer in high def, right? Yeah. But does it, is that like a starting point? It has to be in high def, period? Or if you really love the project, you'd take it in low def?
I mean, for this Frontier, it has to be high def. Or looks high def.
Right.
Looks high def.
It looks high def.
Maybe we want the opposite. We want looks low def.
And we had a question here to this gentleman, right in front row.
Yeah, you said that you had a lot of discussions and, if I heard it right, disagreements with Mr. Fraser about the question of making personal documentaries. And I would like to hear a bit more about these disagreements, and especially Mr. Fraser, what is your position on...
I don't have a position, and I don't actually recall ever having a disagreement with Rudy. I think.
So what is the discussion?
Personal films are fine, but as George Orwell said, all animals equal, whatever. Some films are more personal than others, and I just respond. I only look at films. I do not look at films for ideological illumination. I look at films that give me an absolute wham view of what the world is really like. And if a film is very personal, not quite so personal, I don't care. I don't give a damn. I really don't. I think the whole discussion of authored films and personal films is actually deeply boring and circuitous. But unfortunately, I have to take part in a debate on Friday morning. So while Rudy was saying this, I was thinking, what the fuck am I going to say during this debate? Because I have nothing to say. But there was once an author called Karl Kraus who started a 60-page essay about the Nazis with, about Adolf Hitler, I have nothing significant to say. And then he went on for 60 pages, so maybe I will find something.
For a guy who doesn't have a position. what I think it is? We have great discussions, because in it, I think I've learned a lot from Nick and from each other, I hope. I think our position, we come from different places in terms of our craft, because you come from journalism, and print, don't you?
Yeah.
For journalism.
Yeah, you might say that. Yeah.
And I come from art school. Yeah. So, you know, for me, an artist making a film is like, hey, that's good. I like artists. I actually spent a bit of my life with artists. Yeah. And so when it comes to, I love what an artist does. You know, I love that totally. I mean, the fun thing about TVO was, what does an artist like to do? They like to be totally self-indulgent, because from that work comes something real, because they'll be, they have to go through.
Do you think journalists are not self-indulgent?
That's true. But they're more rigorous about it.
No, they're not. Did anyone see this film called Black Sun?
Yeah.
Oh, fucking wonderful film. And that was just the voice of a man who'd been blinded by having acid thrown in his face over abstract images. It lasted 80 minutes. And I felt I'd attained to Rudy's level of art school nuance by my capability to appreciate this film, you know? Maybe I wasn't such a philistine as I had assumed.
Well, here, let me make a broad generalization, because of course it shifts, but that, you know, the idea with artists is that they, in my opinion, they tend to do, the best work they tend to do is their own work. That tends to be the best work.
Do you think documentaries are actually art?
It can be, of course.
You do?
We
could take a poll on that.
What? Well, like art? No. Well, a poll. Wait a second. That's democracy.
I just think the interesting thing about democracy, it's like a sort of collision at a crossroads of good democracy. And there are all these different ideas about how to look at things in the world. And there are all these different things going on in the world. And, you know, a documentary is a creative collision. And I think what I like about them is that they're not easily defined as art, but sometimes they have moments that attain the status of art. You know what George Orwell said about Animal Farm when he read the reviews? He said, but they never said how beautiful it was. And that is true. A lot of polemical writing has a sort of stark beauty or a kind of nuance, and that's what really interests me. I love the way, I really go on looking at documentaries, because I can get up every morning, and like that little clip from the trains, that tells me a lot. It's like, it's wonderful. It isn't just like reading the newspapers in the morning. It's something very special, but I don't know whether it's art or not.
Well,
and I don't
care. But listen, I don't care about that argument, whether it's art or not. I just am interested in artists doing art, but which is different. But here, my point is this, that I found that when artists do, or the filmmakers do their own work, that's when something wonderful, new, unique has a chance of emerging. Not that it will, but that it has a chance. That journalism, by and large, because most journalism, a lot of journalism is based in organizations. There's very few freelance journalists. They're always working for specific organizations.
I don't agree with you there. They write books.
Okay, never mind that part. But it tends to be, but the daily, thinking of the paper and the new, and news, thinking of the visual side, that it tends to be more prescriptive. You know, something happens, you've got to cover it.
Yeah.
You know, the 9/11 happens. You, if you're a journalist, you know what your assignment is. It's not like you've got a lot of options.
Yeah.
Whereas artists kind of don't wait for events. That they are the. I think that when people are doing their true creative work that emerges from their own environment, they end up doing something that may take them 5 years, but the minute it emerges, it's completely of the time.
But they're bad at the five W's, aren't they?
Yeah, they're absolutely bad, but that's a lack of, you know, sometimes that's a lack of rigor.
We like the five W's, don't we?
Well, you know, I think that there's a lot to, you know, I think that there's a lot to learn from both sides.
Who, why, what, when, and where, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to learn from both sides. Are you having that discussion in NHK? Or are you having a discussion by yourself in NHK?
Oh, you're just working late at night, like Ryota.
You know, until Takahiro showed up on the scene about 5 years ago, I think it was in Amsterdam, TVO used to do a science series, which was, for me, typical NHK. But until Takahiro showed up on the international scene and getting engaged in creative documentary, NHK was a blank wall for most filmmakers. People, you know, there was just nothing happening. But something starts to happen because there's an individual in an organization that says, hey, I think the audiences want something else.
You know, I'm learning from you. Well, you know, NHK is so unique. Like I said, you know, each producer will bring our project to NHK's big meeting, and then we have to get permission. So each producer has kind of a responsibility about each project. So it's not like a commissioning editing system of yours. So, which means individual producer will be very important to get permission.
Yeah.
It's like, how do you say, agent or something of that project.
So you don't have the commissioning system, but if you need any, I know a few out-of-work commissioning editors that might, you know, need a gig, so we can help. That was just a joke, Dr. Kira. Sorry. Are there other questions? Oh, we have something back. A question back here.
Nick mentioned when BBC has one documentary, and then NHK, another channel, will have something similar. So I would like to have an example of that case. And also, it seems among the commissioning editors, there's a fashion trend as well. So I hope you can give me elaborate on that.
Okay. Well, do we follow the fashion?
Yeah, we're all fashion victims. But Rudy is the best-dressed fashion victim I know. But I didn't quite understand the first part of the question. Can you repeat it about the BBC and NHK?
First part of the question is, you mentioned when BBC has a documentary, one kind of a documentary comes out, and there's other station will follow to do something similar.
No, I don't. I don't think it works like that. I think what's happening now is that there are films still made by broadcasters that represent their house style and have a curious homogeneity, like the discoveryization of reality has taken place. And there's you lot out there who are continually, for better or for worse, reinventing what it means to look at the world. I think it's quite rare, and I will probably be strangled for saying this in the BBC, to find truly, truly original and creative work of the kind Rudy was talking about, showing that film about the tracks, made within organizations. And basically, organizations have done deals with the talent out there. They're not fantastic deals. They don't pay you a lot enough, in my view. But they rely on you for creative impulse, creative life. I think the real problem is what Rudy said earlier, is that this is a reversible process. If good commissioning editors are pensioned off or fired, these organizations go into reverse, and they then start showing again the films they were showing 10 years ago. Because television, the way it is set up, is an inherently conformist medium that thrives off repeating itself. And you lot somehow have to make sure that television doesn't always do that, that it receives shocks of talent and novelty and insight the whole time. Does that make sense?
You know, we're out of time. I think you summed that up really nicely. The subject today was carte blanche.
But you didn't see the Chinese movie.
We didn't see the movie. Well, it was their backup.
It's very good, though.
It's very well. Maybe we can.
You can play people. It's very funny. So.
Is it?
Oh yes.
3 minutes. Can we roll it as our last 3 minutes? We'll let us take us out, as they say.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you, Takahiro.
Thank you.
Thanks, Nick.